We are, as you know, continuing our studies of the historical background to the Bible, and especially we're thinking these days of the New Testament. In the last several weeks, we've been doing the run-up, really, to the New Testament, looking largely at the rise of Rome. And last time we were together, which was 2 weeks back, we were looking at the first real Caesar, or emperor, of Rome, who was, of course, Augustus Caesar, a.k.a. Octavian. And we talked a little bit about his story. And I want to now do a sort of sub-topic under this Caesar, and that has to do with this character that we run into in the New Testament known as Herod. So this morning we're going to be considering Herod, otherwise known as Herod the Great. I'm not sure why he's so great, but he's nevertheless had that epithet attached to him down through the centuries. The text that I'd like to have us keep in the back of our minds as we consider this fellow is the one of two texts in the New Testament that mentions Herod by name. You probably know there's several Herods. All of these other Herods, Antipas, Herod Philip, the Agrippas, all of them are descendants of Herod the Great. So we're going to start with the wellspring here, as it were, and then we will at least touch on these other guys a little bit before we're done. We'll probably be dealing with them a little bit more as time goes on in weeks to come. But let's at least get the first guy in the list before us, and that is Herod, otherwise known as Herod the Great. He's mentioned, as I say, twice in the New Testament, once just in passing in the Gospel of Luke, where Luke, helping us to triangulate the chronology of events, says that it was while Herod was ruling in Judah, or Judea. It was when Quirinius was ruling in Syria. You recall he gives us several different benchmarks by which to measure the events, the timing of the events of the New Testament, and especially the birth of Christ. The text in the New Testament that gives us a little bit more attention with respect to Herod is Matthew chapter 2, and that's the one that I'd like to look at with you briefly. This, of course, is familiar because it's commonly read at Christmas time, and we'll probably be hearing it again as the Christmas season approaches. But we're going to look at it this morning not so much for its Christmas message, but for the picture that it paints for us of this character that we know of as Herod. So I'd like to read this. We'll read the whole chapter this morning, and this is, in fact, the only chapter that really treats in any detail this particular character. This, by the way, is toward the end of his life. He's probably around, at this time, 70 years old, maybe a little more, 72, 73. He has, by this time, become universally despised among the Jewish people. There was a time when he was somewhat popular, but that has deteriorated in recent years. He's toward the end of his life. He's not in good health. He's definitely seized by a kind of paranoia. And we see the evidence of that richly displayed in this text. So let's look at it. We're in Matthew chapter 2, beginning at verse 1. Oh, there it is. And this is the word of God. In the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem asking, "Where's the child who's been born king of the Jews? For we observed his star in the east and have come to pay him homage." When King Herod heard this, he was frightened, and all Jerusalem with him. And calling together all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them where the Messiah was to be born. They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it has been written by the prophet, quote, 'And you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come a ruler who is to shepherd my people Israel.' Then Herod secretly called for the wise men and learned from them the exact time when the star had appeared. Then he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, 'Go and search diligently for the child, and when you found him, bring me word so that I may also go and pay him homage.' When they'd heard the king, they set out, and there ahead of them went the star that they had seen in the east, until it stopped over the place where the young child was. When they saw that the star had stopped, they were overwhelmed with joy. On entering the house, they saw Mary. They saw the child with Mary, his mother, and they knelt down and paid him homage. Then opening their treasure chests, they offered him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they left for their own country by another road. Now after they had left, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there until I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother by night, and went to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what had been spoken by the Lord through the prophet, "Out of Egypt I have called my son." When Herod saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, he was infuriated, and he sent and killed all the children in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old or under, according to the time that he had learned from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what had been spoken through the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing and loud lamentation. Rachel, weeping for her children, she refused to be consoled because they are no more. When Herod died, an angel of the Lord suddenly appeared in a dream to Joseph in Egypt and said, "Get up, take the child and his mother, and go to the land of Israel. For those who were seeking the child's life are dead." Then Joseph got up, took the child and his mother, and went to the land of Israel. But when he heard that Archelaus was ruling over Judah in place of his father Herod, he was afraid to go there. And after being warned in a dream, he went away to the district of Galilee. There he made his home in a town called Nazareth, so that what had been spoken through the prophets might be fulfilled: "He will be called a Nazareun," or a branch is probably the meaning of that. So there's our text. Let's ask God's blessing on our reflection on the background to this story. Our Father, we're grateful for your mercies. We thank you for a new day, for all of the good works that you have before ordained, that we should walk in them. We thank you that whatever you've called us to do, you've given us grace to accomplish. We pray that as we reflect now on this most well-known text, that we would see in it lessons that will encourage and strengthen our own faith and our own life. And to that end, we commit this time now in the name of Christ. Amen. All right. Herod the Great, born 74. He was born. I'm going to give you his life in about four short chapters here. So we'll start appropriately enough with his early life. He was born at a very early age, as the saying goes. He was born to a character named Antipater, who was from Idumea. He was married to a woman, Antipater was, from Nabatea. So these two regions are to the south of Israel. We talked about Idumea a little bit last time. You recall Idumea is the New Testament reference to the Old Testament region known as Edom. And so Herod, as well as his father, were Edomites, descending from that tribe of people that had been related to the Jewish people, but had always had a somewhat hostile relationship to them. The Nabataeans are off to the east a little ways. If you've ever traveled in the Holy Land, you may have visited the most famous site, which is part of ancient Nabatea, which is a city called Petra, where you have this city kind of carved into the side of a mountain. This is at least reportedly one of the places Christians escaped to during the siege of Jerusalem in 70 AD when the Romans were attacking that city. They fled into the Judean wilderness, and among other places, some of them wound up here. Anybody ever visited this site? Have you been there? It's pretty impressive, isn't it? I've never been there. Yeah, it is quite a sight. So if you ever have a chance to stop off in Nabatea, you might want to take that in. But as I say, the father of Herod came from Idumea, his mother came from Nabatea, and the two of them then in this somewhat political relationship, nevertheless married and had Herod among other children. Antipater was himself an official who served under John Hyrcanus II. Now you recall we talked about that last time we were together. John Hyrcanus was the last of the Hasmonean rulers. The Hasmoneans went back to the Maccabean revolt. They had become the de facto royalty, the nobility in Israel. Is that too loud? Is it hurting your ears? It's okay? All right. Okay. It seems awfully loud to me, but when I see you back there going like this, then that'll be my clue. But right now it seems okay. So anyway, John Hyrcanus was the Jewish ruler in Judah, of course, in that time frame just before the Romans came. And if you recall, last time we were together, we were saying that John Hyrcanus was driven out by his brother-in-law. He came back with a force to try to retake Jerusalem, and it was while Jerusalem was under siege that the Roman general Pompey showed up and cooked up a deal with John Hyrcanus in which he would be reinstated to authority in Jerusalem, but only as high priest, not as king. So at that point, Judah came under the Roman control of a governor, but it still had a religious ruler in the person of the high priest, and at least for a while, that was John Hyrcanus. Antipater, as it turned out, was an official who was serving under John Hyrcanus, and so he actually had some rather significant position to play at that time. In 74, toward the end of the career of Antipater, he was actually appointed the governor in Judah. And so Antipater becomes the political representative of Rome in the region of Judah, and he assigned his son Herod to the region north known as Galilee. It was still subservient to his father. Herod was serving under the authority of his father, but he had that separate responsibility up in Galilee. And that's the first time, really, that we have Herod showing up. So 47 is the year, and Herod becomes, at about 25 years old, a governor serving under his father in Galilee. It's the first time he hits the radar screen. You recall what's happening in Rome right now. I should give you a little quiz, shouldn't I? What's happening in Rome right now? What happened in 49? Anybody remember off the top of your head? Caesar crossed the Rubicon. Remember that? And of course now that throws Rome into civil war. And we're right in the thick of the conflict between Julius Caesar on the one hand and Pompey on the other, in which Caesar is attempting on the one hand to defeat Pompey and yet at the same time to win him back as a political ally. You know that complicated story we talked about last time. So right now, right in the midst of that, when Rome is in something of a, you know, significant turmoil, that's the moment when Antipater and Herod insert themselves into the politics of Judea around the year 47. In 43, Antipater himself was assassinated. We don't know exactly the circumstances. Josephus says it was something about a tax debt or something. We don't know for sure. But in any event, he was assassinated. And his son Herod just kind of insinuated himself into the role that his father had played. At this point, it's not confirmed by Rome yet. We don't know exactly at this point. He didn't know if he was going to be able to hang on to this plum, but he was hoping to, just sort of taking over what his father had been done, more or less on a provisional basis. The reason Rome could not immediately confirm him or fire him, either one, is because, as you know, at this point, Julius Caesar has just been assassinated in 44. And in 42, we have the Battle of Philippi, in which Octavian and Mark Antony are going to defeat Brutus and Cassius. And until that happens, we don't know exactly who's going to be the winning team in this ongoing conflict in Rome. And so Herod, kind of under the radar, and while all these other controversies are taking place, can just sort of move in. And, you know, 90% of the law is just possession, and I think Herod understood that. So he just kind of moves in and takes over in his father's absence now and hopes that he'll be able to weather the storm and hang on to that position. So that's more or less the way in which he got into Jewish politics in the first place. Well, when the battle between the forces representing the Senate, the conspirators who had killed Julius Caesar, fought with the forces that more or less were aligned with the, you know, with Julius Caesar, who's now dead, but it would be his nephew Octavian and Mark Antony, his chief commander. When that battle took place at Philippi in 42 and the dust settled. We know, of course, the winners were Mark Antony and Octavian, and Herod immediately declared his loyalty for those two. I was with you guys all along, you know, that was the kind of thing. He immediately indicates that he is their loyal follower, and that was good enough for them. And so they actually confirm Herod at that point as the governor in Judea. So Octavian, this is before he's become Augustus Caesar, when he's still now kind of jockeying for a position himself in the Roman world, does confirm the role that Herod has there as governor of Judea. That takes place in 42. 2 years later, Herod is driven out. And this takes place at the hands of a character named Antigonus, who was Hasmonean. The Hasmoneans, as we were indicating, were kind of the ruling class, sort of the nobility of the Jewish world, but now they're under the thumb of Rome. But nevertheless, they're accorded a certain amount of respect. But this guy was a little bit of a maverick. He thought that Jewish independence should be reinstated. He didn't like the Roman presence there. And so he goes and sees if he can get an army to support him. And the place he goes to get the army is a place called Parthia. So Parthia, the purple part of this map, is a fairly good-sized empire in its own right at this point. This would basically be about the year zero, but it's pretty much the same at the time frame we're discussing. Parthia is east of any of the holdings of Rome. It would include Mesopotamia and points extending into at least part of India. It was a good-sized piece of real estate, and the Parthians had always been regarded by Rome as a nice big plum that they would have enjoyed, you know, taking. The last time they had attempted to do that was the first triumvirate, you recall, with Julius Caesar and Pompey and a character named Crassus. And Crassus had wanted to get a military commission, and indeed did get it with Caesar's help, wanting to go and take Parthia. This was back in the 60s BC. He failed. He was killed in the effort. That was the last real attempt that Rome made to try to take Parthia. So Parthia's out there. It's an independent empire, and they don't like Rome in their backyard. They don't like this Roman presence as close as the Holy Land, and so they're receptive to a proposal by Antigonus, the Hasmonean, to say, hey, why don't you put up an army for me, and let's go drive those Romans out. You can install me as the ruler, and I will be faithful and loyal to Parthia. You see, and so they say, oh, that sounds good to us. So they provide an army, and they go, and in fact, they drive out Herod in the year 40. So this attack is successful. The Romans are driven out. Herod is driven out, and at least for a brief period of time, Parthia is the main game in town. Herod himself has to escape with his life, and so he flees to Rome in the year 40. And while there, he seeks from Rome help to reinstate him in his position of rule. At this point, you know, he's what, about 35 years old, and he's declaring his loyalty to Rome, and he wants their help, and so he negotiates and finally is able to appear before the Senate and make his case, and the Senate indeed agrees with him. All Herod is asking for is that he be installed once again as the governor. The Senate actually goes one better and says, hey, how's about we make you king of the Jews? And that becomes a critical factor in the drama that plays out in the New Testament. Because, of course, in Matthew chapter 2 and elsewhere, we find there are two people on the scene, both of whom are claiming to be what? King of the Jews. One is Herod, and one is this newborn Messiah. And part of the dynamic that plays out is this competition between these two. So the Roman Senate actually, and somehow in God's providence, is the one that makes Herod, at least puts him in the official position, to be the counterpart to God's Messiah, who is going to come on the scene in the text that we just looked at a little bit earlier. So anyway, the Senate appoints Herod to be that king of the Jews, and immediately Mark Antony steps up and says, hey, look, Herod, I will help you retake your lost holdings there in Judah. So Mark Antony, who of course is now one of the prominent characters in Rome, he's one of that second triumvirate, along with Octavian and Lepidus, you recall those guys. And so Mark Antony takes a pretty good-sized Roman military force, and they travel, and for 2 years, There's a battle between Rome on the one hand and the Parthians over the other, or on the other, over the disposition of Jerusalem. But finally in 37, the Romans win, the Parthians are driven home, Antigonus is killed, and Herod is put into the position now, king of the Jews. And so he'd have the official title 2 years earlier, now to the Jewish people. He's actually installed in that position. There's a great kind of celebration. I don't know how excited the Jewish people actually were to have a foreigner in that position, an Idumean in that role, an Edomite. You see, there was a lot of bad blood between these two people groups down through the history of their relationship. But nevertheless, at this point, Herod is installed in that position. Well, the next chapter then of the life of Herod is Herod trying to consolidate his position. He knew he was on thin ice, not with Rome, but with the Jewish people. And a ruler needs at least some degree of support from the local people, you know. He couldn't simply be iron-fisted. He had to have, hopefully, engender a certain amount of support, a certain amount of sympathy among these folks. And he was trying to figure out the best way to do it. And the first thing that occurred to him was to marry a woman by the name of Miriam. Spelled something like Mariamne, but it's usually pronounced Miriam. Miriam was a Hasmonean princess. By all accounts, she was a beautiful woman in her late teenage years. And Herod was hoping by marrying her that he would ingratiate himself into the minds and hearts of the Jewish people, because the Jewish people loved her. And they loved the Hasmoneans. And they loved that kind of de facto royalty among them. They didn't like the Romans so much, but this was sort of a buffer. The Hasmoneans were a bit of a buffer between the Jewish people and the Romans, and the Hasmoneans were respected. They had indeed been responsible for the Maccabean revolt. So when Herod marries her, in a sense, he is selling himself to the Jewish people in a way that worked pretty well. His polling numbers went up. And the only problem he had is he was already married. And so he had to do something with his first wife, whose name was Doris, and her son, by their marriage, whose name was Antipater, named in honor of the father. And so he banishes her and the son. They both just become histoire, they're gone, and now he has this new marriage to Miriam. So that takes place in 37. So far, so good. The Jewish people think, this guy's not so bad. Look, he's married to this beautiful Miriam, and so all is well. Herod decides that he's got enough momentum and things have gone well so far. He takes the next step to further increase his popularity, and he installs the brother of Miriam into the position of high priest. You know that by now the high priesthood in Jerusalem was as much political as religious. There were not legitimate people holding this. These are not descendants of Aaron, as you know. These are simply political appointments. And at this point, Herod steps up and appoints Aristobulus, about a 20-year-old kid, to the role of high priest in Jerusalem. But the Jewish people loved it. They liked the Hasmoneans. They liked this young man. He was good-looking, and he seemed to be someone that they could trust. And so they actually welcomed him as their high priest. And Herod, at the moment, thought, well, this is good. Things are going well. But as he observed what was going on, he noted that they actually seemed to like Aristobulus a little more than they liked Herod. And then he got to be a little nervous. And this, as near as we can tell, is kind of the beginning of an ongoing and increasing paranoia that seemed to seize the psychology of Herod. It begins right here with this concern he has about Aristobulus, who all of a sudden is getting more public acclaim, more, you know, talk show interviews, more, photographs in the press and so on. And Herod seems to feel a little bit frozen out. And so in the face of that, he decides that he doesn't want this guy threatening his position. And so he calls a little party. He says, hey, everybody, come over to my house. We're going to have a backyard swimming pool party. Throw some shrimp on the barbie and, that kind of thing. And so everybody comes over. There's a little drinking. There's a little partying. There's a little dancing. There's a little swimming in the pool. And wouldn't you know it, about 2 a.m., they find the body of Aristobulus floating in about 2 feet of water. Nobody's ever been able to pin Herod with that crime. The jury is still out, but historians are more or less unanimous that that was cooked up by Herod himself. And so Herod, this is his first true political assassination. And this was a kind of a moment, I think, in his own development as a political character. So Aristobulus dies. That did have a chilling effect on his relationship to Marium, because this was, after all, her brother, who was found dead floating in the swimming pool. They remained married, but the relationship between them was definitely not quite as warm as it had been. Things remain more or less status quo for about 3 years, and then Herod is facing a huge problem in Nabatea, the home of his mother, which is now revolted against his authority. They view him as a weak leader, and they think that they can probably wiggle out from under Herod's control and maybe even Roman control, and so all of a sudden Herod is facing a significant challenge with respect to Nabatea. And he probably would have been able to handle that okay, except, as you recall, 32 is also the year that another civil war broke out in Rome, this time between Octavian and Mark Antony and Cleopatra. And so that civil war kind of throws everything into chaos. Herod doesn't have the resources necessary to fight a military campaign in Nabatea as he would have liked, because Roman resources are being all tied up elsewhere, and he has a very difficult time dealing with this Nabatean revolt. He's not able to put it down right away, and it becomes an increasingly difficult problem for him to manage. By the time we reach 31, things are heading toward the Battle of Actium. And you recall Actium is that sea battle that took place off the coast of Greece, in which we have the forces of Octavian and the forces of Mark Antony that meet in that pitched battle, and of course, as it turns out, Mark Antony is defeated. He and Elizabeth Taylor commit suicide, and that's the end of that story, you know. But the problem is, Herod had thrown his support behind Mark Antony, because, of course, Mark Antony had supported Herod to be installed as king of the Jews. And Herod felt he had a loyalty, a kind of responsibility there to support Mark Antony. And it's always difficult in politics to support the losing team, you know. And so Octavian was of a mind to sack Herod. One, because he couldn't put down the revolt in Nabatea. Two, even worse, he had supported the wrong side in the Battle of Actium. And three, he just didn't like the guy's sort of style. You know, we do get this feeling that Octavian didn't ever like Herod very much. So in the year 30, Herod, now faced with a huge problem, facing the very live prospect that he's going to be canned, goes to Rome. And this is one of the most remarkable incidents in his career. He goes and he basically grovels at the feet of Octavian. He apologizes up one side and down the other. He tries to explain what had happened. He says, "There's no more loyal subject in all the empire than me. I'm your man. I'm going to do whatever I can to, you know, build up your reputation," and so on. And Herod is so convincing that Octavian says, "Okay, man, okay, I'll give you another chance." And so Herod is able to save his career, save his skin for that matter. And in 30 AD, he's able to go back then with a straight face once again as the ruler in Jerusalem. So that was kind of the time of consolidating power. Pretty bumpy road, but nevertheless, now, without much question or challenge to his authority, he's there in Jerusalem. And this opens up the third chapter, as I'm calling it, of his career, Herod the Nervous Builder. There's two themes that are more or less running concurrently during this 20 years. One, Herod is nervous. You see the rising effects of a kind of paranoia touching most of what he does. And so he's always got his eye in the rearview mirror. He's always kind of watching his backside. He has that kind of insecurity that goes with someone who is really not sure of how people feel about him and concerned that there may be a knife in his back sometime when he least expects it. So he's paranoid, but he's also trying to prove himself to Octavian. And so he's building in a lavish scale all around the region, not only of Jerusalem, but actually throughout the Roman world in many different places. He built quite impressive structures and so on. most of which was dedicated to Octavian, aka Augustus Caesar. And so he's trying to win points, you see, back home with the Romans, and at the same time trying to walk this tightrope of his political fortunes with the Jewish people. Well, it all starts in 29. This is part of the nervousness. He has Mariam, executed on charges of infidelity. It's very unlikely that she had been unfaithful. It is pretty likely, however, that their relationship had chilled, and Herod was beginning to be increasingly suspicious that she might be thinking of being involved in some kind of conspiracy to do away with him. And the more he worried about it, the more he kind of drummed up in his imagination various scenarios, and all of them sort of pointed to her. This does seem to be a moment when his own psychology was even more unhinged, because he really did love her. It seems that she was the one woman he really did love. And so when he had her executed, it did something to him. But nevertheless, that was what he felt he had to do, and within his kind of twisted psychology, it became necessary. Josephus tells us that as Miriam was facing the executioner, she had a calm equanimity about her, as someone who knew that she had done no wrong and didn't seem in the least to fear death. She had a sort of cool composure. She was only 25 years old, and yet as she faces the executioner, Josephus rather celebrates the dignity with which she conducted herself as she faced that prospect. But in any event, she was put to death in 29. 28, the following year, Herod then executes his brother-in-law, who was the brother of Mariam, a man by the name of Costobar. He charges him and executes him on charges of conspiracy, and in this case, he was probably right. Costobar was fully convinced that Herod had lost his mind, that something had to be done to get rid of this guy, and he was indeed apparently a part of a conspiracy to do Herod in. Herod got wind of it and was able to get rid of this guy. So we begin to see these sort of assassinations and executions taking place, all of which give evidence to Herod's desire to protect and secure his own position. At the same time, he begins rather impressive building projects. The first of these was a city called Sebaste, which was in Samaria. Sebaste was a term which actually had roots connected to Augustus and was actually a city that was designed to celebrate Augustus and his great, wonderful genius as the emperor of Rome. You do remember from last time, I hope, that in 27, the Senate conferred on Octavian the term Augustus, the August One, the one worthy of worship. And at that point, of course, Augustus Caesar was really, without any contest whatsoever, the most powerful man in the world. And so Herod is doing whatever he can to try to be a cheerleader for Augustus Caesar, and this is only one of several attempts on his part to accomplish that. In 25, one of the things for which he was remembered warmly was that he waived taxes and distributed grain to the Jewish people because of a severe famine that had come through the land, and they did appreciate that, so that was kind of a more positive thing he did. In 23, he built his own palace and a facility outside Jerusalem called the Herodion, which is mentioned in the New Testament. Josephus gives us the following description of this fortress facility that was outside of Jerusalem. He says, quote, "This fortress, which is some 60 stadia, about 20 miles, distant from Jerusalem, is naturally strong and very suitable for such a structure. For reasonably nearby is a hill raised to a greater height by the hand of man and rounded off in the image of a breast. At intervals, it has round towers and it has a steep ascent, forming 200 steps of hewn stone. Within it are costly royal apartments made for security and for ornament at the same time. At the base of the hill, there are pleasure grounds built in such a way as to be worth seeing, among other things, because of the way in which the water, which is lacking in that place, is brought in from a distance and at great expense. The surrounding plain is built up as a city, second to none, with the hill serving as an acropolis for other dwellings." Some of you have been in that region and you've probably seen this. It's a man-made mountain. And so Herod, at great expense and with some degree of engineering genius, was able to actually create this. This is not, by the way, Masada. That's a separate fortress that he also built, but this is not too far from Jerusalem. It was quite a little sort of wonderland up atop of sort of a fun and games place, but it was also intended to be a fortress, and it's one of the part of the legacy, really, of Herod's rule at that time. He also began construction of a city which is not too far from present-day Tel Aviv. It's over toward the coast. It was called Caesarea Maritima. In the New Testament, it's simply called Caesarea. It's where Paul was imprisoned for a couple of years, first under Felix, then under Festus, if you remember that in the latter part of the book of Acts. The city of Caesarea is also not to be confused with Caesarea Philippi, which was up to the north, where Peter confessed, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." This is a separate place. A lot of cities were called Caesarea because a lot of people wanted to score points with Caesar, and this was no exception. This was called Caesarea Maritima, that is the maritime Caesarea. It was a remarkable engineering feat. Herod actually perfected a method of laying concrete, wet concrete, underwater to form strong footings that became a foundation for a facility that would extend out over the surface of the water, and it became quite a sort of ancient water world. You know, it was quite a thing and was very famous, and so that was part of his production as well. In 20, his most famous project got underway, which was the construction of the temple in Jerusalem called Herod's Temple. It was a refurbishing of the second temple that had been built under the Persians many years earlier, but now, of course, Herod wants to, in a grand way, sell himself to the Jewish people, and this was by far his most lavish and extraordinary building project, and it produced this. This is a model of it that's in the Israel Museum. If you look at it closely, I don't know how that shows, you can see those stones there that make up that outer wall. Those stones, each one weighed several tons. This thing was huge. And that's part of the reason for the backstory when we hear in the Synoptic Gospels during Holy Week, when Jesus is just pronouncing these sort of significant pronouncements of condemnation and judgment against Jerusalem, the disciples themselves can hardly believe their ears. And as they're departing from the temple, they are said to have pointed out to Jesus these great stones, as if to say to him, are you sure you know what you're talking about here? Look at those stones, they're huge. And that, of course, calls forth from Jesus that most remarkable statement that he makes. Do you see these stones? I say to you, not one stone is going to be left upon another. All is going to be cast down. And then a little later he says this generation will not pass away until all of these things are fulfilled. It would have seemed unthinkable to those guys to imagine all of those colossal stones being cast down within that generation. Did it happen within that generation? Yeah. In 70 AD, the Romans came in, and indeed that whole temple structure was demolished. The only thing that's ever left is called the Wailing Wall, which is actually part of a perimeter way out to the outside of it that you're familiar with, of course, in current history as well. But anyway, it did happen as Jesus foretold, and that was the temple, or at least a likely replica of the temple. All right, the last chapter of Herod's life I'm calling Herod the Paranoid. He was already well on his way, but this is really kind of when it developed a head of steam. The temple, by the way, was dedicated in the year 10 to great celebration. This was probably the high point of his career, and yet it was the point when he was at the same time riddled with all kinds of anxieties and fears and so on. His hope, of course, was that the Jewish people would love him so much because of this temple that he had built that it would allay his fears, but it didn't. And part of the reason is because these were all, of course, the demons that were invading his life and psychology by this time, apart from how the public may have been perceiving him. In the year 9, Caesarea Maritima was inaugurated as well. In the year 8, the two sons that were born of his wife Miriam, who was his favorite, were accused of high treason. These two men were named Alexander and Aristobulus, and the following year, based on those accusations of treason, which were probably false, those two sons were executed. So for the first time, Herod is now executing his sons, you see, and these two are the first to go. Herod then proceeds in about the year 6 against the Pharisees, who were pretty hostile to him and pretty overt and public in their hostility. And quite a bit of bloodshed took place at this point as he proceeds against them for that political resistance. In the year 5, Antipater, his first son, born of Doris, is charged with treason, and he's executed in the year 4. So now Herod has killed 3 of his sons. This is part of the reason that Augustus Caesar was noted as saying, "You're better off being Herod's pig than being his son," you know. And that was at least to some degree true, I think, based on this career. Herod himself died sometime around the year 4, maybe 3, some would say as late as 2. But he certainly died before 0. The birth of Christ, I think you're aware, is probably going to be somewhere in the range of 6, 5, 4, something like that, B.C. Jesus was born 5 years B.C. Just one of those little calendar anomalies that's come down to us. And so the end of Herod's life is a miserable story indeed. He was beset with some kind of physical malady, which was loathsome and awful and painful. He was also universally disliked in spite of the temple. All the things he'd done, especially executing his sons and so on, had just caused public opinion to turn pretty much universally against him. And he knew on his death there was likely to be nothing but celebration. He knew that. And so he arrested some young men on charges of vandalism. They had tried to rip a Roman eagle off the temple because it was a pagan symbol. They were arrested, thrown in prison, and Herod, and they were very popular in among the Jewish people for this heroic act. Herod ordered that on his death, they would at the same time be executed. He wanted to make sure people were crying in Jerusalem the day he died, you see. He did die, and immediately the first act that took place was to stay that order, and those guys were released and given a hero's welcome in Jerusalem. So as it turns out, nobody was weeping on the death of Herod. Let me just give you quickly here the family tree. Sometimes we read the New Testament, it can be a little bit confusing who these characters are, and so if this is helpful, then let's just run through this. Herod had 10 wives. We only care about the first 5 because it was by them that he had children. The first of them, as you know, was Doris. She had one son, Antipater. The second wife was Miriam. We've mentioned her. She had 2 sons, Alexander and Aristobulus. Those first 3 were all executed for charges of treason in sometime around between the years of 4 and 7 BC, as it indicates there. His second wife was another Miriam. This is Miriam II. She gave birth to a young fellow named Herod Philip. And oddly enough, Herod had 2 sons, Herod Philip. I don't know quite why you would do that, but he did. This is the first of them. This Herod Philip just disappears from the radar screen. I think he wound up selling life insurance in Rome or something. He said, "The kitchen is too hot, I'm out of here." And so he just left, and nothing more was heard of him. End of conversation. Then he marries a woman named Maltase. She has 2 sons, Herod Archelaus and Herod Antipas. One of them is alluded to in Matthew chapter 2, Archelaus, who was reigning in the place of his father when Herod died. And he was worse than his father, apparently, and Rome actually sacked him in the year 6 A.D., so Archelaus didn't reign for very long. He did nothing but bad. He was exiled. That's the last we hear of him. But that was, of course, the reason Joseph didn't want to return to the precincts of Jerusalem, because he heard that Archelaus was reigning and that he was as bad as his father. The other one is Herod Antipas. He's mentioned in the New Testament. He's the guy who stole the wife of his half-brother, the other Herod Philip, and for that was publicly condemned by John the Baptist. And John the Baptist, of course, was arrested by Antipas and eventually executed by Antipas under pressure from his wife, the very woman that he had stolen from Herod Philip. So that whole intricate story is tied together with that guy. Herod Antipas is also the Herod before whom Jesus appeared at his trial. Remember, Pilate learned that Jesus was from Galilee, and so he sent him to Herod Antipas. And Herod Antipas wanted Jesus to do some magic tricks. He didn't, and Antipas sent him back, that whole little story we hear of in the Passion narrative. Then the next wife of Herod is named Cleopatra. No connections to the Cleopatras in Egypt, but she's the one who brings into the world this young Herod Philip II, who becomes the ruler of Perea and is the one from whom you know, the wife was stolen by Herod Antipas. There are two other Herods that are mentioned in the New Testament, not on this list. One is Agrippa the First. This is the Agrippa who was struck by God for not disclaiming worship, and the New Testament says he was eaten by worms. You recall that, Acts chapter 12. Josephus gives us precisely the same story. And so that is a well-attested event, both in external sources and in the New Testament. He was the son of Aristobulus, who was the son of Miriam. The other Herod that shows up is Agrippa the Second. This is the Agrippa before whom Paul made his defense in the latter part of the book of Acts. And he's the one who said this man could have been released had he not appealed to Caesar. This is the grandson of Aristobulus and the great-grandson of Herod the Great. So that's all of them. Seven Herods in all in the New Testament, and that's them. All right, more than you ever wanted to know about the Herods, right? But hopefully that is helpful. For our Sunday school lesson this morning, let's come back and think about this text in Matthew. I was alluding to this a little bit earlier. Matthew chapter 2 tells us about two kings of the Jews. So we have in verse 1, in the time of King Herod, after Jesus was born, wise men came from the east asking, "Where is the child who has been born king of the Jews?" At this point, the Jewish people had two kings. And if you will allow me to, without stretching the point too far, I'm not trying to become allegorical here or anything like that, but I want to at least make what I think is a legitimate point. Just as the Jewish people in the first century had to choose between two kings, and as Jesus himself says, no man can serve two masters, so there is, in a sense, in every one of our lives, two kings. You all know that, don't you? There is within us a Herod, and there is within us Jesus. The Herod within you, that king who goes by many names in the New Testament, Paul talks about the flesh and the spirit and other terms that are used, that Herod is as capable of wicked, dastardly, horrific deeds as was the Herod that we find here in the New Testament. Every one of us has within us, and when we're the least bit honest with ourselves and look deeply inside, we know it's true. We have this ruler within us who will do awful things, like a caged animal, if threatened. And that Herod is the one you never want to let rule. But all of us have had experience, I bet, at moments when we know that Herod was ruling, and we did things, as Paul says in Romans chapter 6, for which we were later ashamed. You will rarely do things under the dominance of that Herod for which you are later proud, you know. Well, how do you know who's ruling in your life? I think these two kings give us some clues. Herod was all about external show, about public opinion, worried about how people were feeling about him, worried about the way he was being perceived. Anytime you find yourself obsessing over how are people viewing me, that's not a good sign. Anytime you find yourself preoccupied with what are those people thinking, what are they saying, that's the Herod within you. The Jesus that was born into this text was born in a barn, laid in a feed trough, wrapped in little bands of cloth. The only dignity he had, the only public image he could enjoy, was a little star up in the sky. But that was enough. For us, we need to ask ourselves, who am I really trying to please here? People? Or is there a God in heaven, and is it that one that I'm concerned about pleasing? Paul raises the question in Galatians, who am I now trying to please, God or man? It's a legitimate question that's worthy of being asked in the heart of any thoughtful Christian every day of your life. Who am I trying to please right now? If I'm trying to please people, that's Herod. And you need to do something with that guy. Second little criterion. Herod-type rulers operate on the predicate, might makes right. we win arguments by outshouting the other side, or swinging a bigger stick, or strutting our power, or being pushy. Whenever you see yourself getting your way just by being pushy, that's a bad sign. Now, some people are pretty good at being pushy. I used to be a lawyer, you know. I know about being pushy. It's a bad sign. Whether you're practicing law or practicing parenthood or practicing being a boss at work or any other context of life, when you find that the way you get what you want is by being pushy, that's Herod. You see, might makes right. What about Jesus? I think you'd have to agree with me, there's probably never been a less pushy guy in the history of the world. And yet, the amount of power that was wielded by this non-pushy guy is a wonder. I think about the story of the Apostle Paul and Silas on the second missionary journey when they were in Philippi. And they were arrested and thrown into jail. They'd been whipped, scourged, beaten. They were bloody and messy and hurting and not comfortable. And these were not nice accommodations. They were in stocks. If anybody had a reason to feel like we really didn't get a fair shake here, you know, it would be Paul and Silas. So what are they doing at midnight? What are they doing? Singing and praying. There's a little phrase I heard once, maybe you've heard it. Worship is warfare. But worship is not the warfare as is conducted by this world. Now, I'm not disputing that sometimes we need to go to war in the conventional sense of the word. But right now, you know, in terms of the Christian ethic, there is something powerful about the warfare wielded by worship. There's a great story in the Old Testament about Jehoshaphat, who was facing overwhelming odds in a battleground situation, and the people that he sent into the battle as his front line were not the bazookas and the army tanks. They were singers. The front line, singers. And it worked such confusion on the army facing them that they essentially self-destructed. When Paul and Silas were singing in the prison, God stepped in and there was an earthquake. You know the story. So whenever you find yourself being pushy, that's a bad sign. That may be Herod working out his devices in you. The motivations of Herod are insecurity, fear, self-protection, watching your backside. That's the methodology, that's the motivation of Herod. The motivation of a true Christian, someone who knows where they stand with Christ, is a kind of serene confidence. The best image I know of in the New Testament is Jesus himself walking on the water. He wasn't just walking on a swimming pool there. He wasn't just walking on, you know, calm, tranquil seas. This was a tumultuous storm. And Peter got out of the boat, and as long as he fixed his eyes on Christ, the same storm was no more threatening to him than it was to Jesus. But as soon as he started watching his backside, started looking around, looking at all these waves, then he went down. You know, Herod, Jesus, who are you worshiping? So anyway, I think these two kings of the Jews are a little bit of a lesson for us as well. And I hope that is helpful. I apologize. I have to just beat it out of here fast because I'm involved in the music in the next service. I know you have wonderful comments, and it breaks my heart not to hear them. But I'm going to leave anyway. So, sorry for that. But let's have a word of prayer, and we'll be dismissed. Our Father, we are so grateful for the New Testament, which gives us with such clarity the real issues of life. We thank you that as awful and ghastly as this man was, Herod does stand for something, which is a lesson we need to learn. We hear Jesus warn us that we can't serve God and mammon. We can't serve this world, even the best of what it offers. It is not worthy of our adoration compared to you. And so we pray that you would bring clarity in our hearts and minds, and that we would be those people who repeatedly, daily, with heartfelt allegiance and loyalty, give ourselves unreservedly to King Jesus, the true King of the Jews and the true King of the cosmos, and indeed the King in our lives. And we ask these things in his name. Amen.